This is Audible.
Brilliance Audio. Phantom by H.D. Carleton. Performed by Summer Morton
and Stephen Dexter.
Author's note. First, please keep in mind that this story takes place during the 1940s. Not only was the language slightly different then, but the value of the dollar was also vastly different from what it is now. While I tried to stay accurate to the time period, some liberties may have been taken for the sake of the story. Second, if you are reading this after the cat and mouse duet, then you are familiar with Gigi's diary. Please note that Gigi wrote in her journal every day, so there are hundreds of entries detailing events and information that you may be unaware of. Happy reading! Important note. This is a dark romance with triggering situations such as stalking, cheating, not between love interests, graphic violence and murder, graphic language, on-page rape and domestic violence, not between love interests, alcohol addiction and codependency with an addict, mentions of infertility and traumatic labor, and explicit sexual situations. There are also kinks such as degradation, breath play, and fear play. Please heed these warnings seriously. Your mental health matters. To view and listen to the theme playlist, visit https://bit.ly/phantompl. For the 1940s playlist, visit https://bit.ly/phantom40pl. May 26th, 1944. My mother always told me I was different. She would spit the word at me like it was rotten fruit on her tongue. I thought it was because of my deep love for Gothic literature. She had trouble getting my nose out of Mary Shelley's Frankenstein or my favorite Edgar Allan Poe stories. As a child, I told her I wanted to live in a house that was built to look like the inside of their brains. Gothic, dark, spooky, I'd even say. My mother recoiled at that and called me crazy. She called me many other despicable names, but I won't give her the satisfaction of repeating them, even in ink. But what would she think now? She passed away when I was 23, but even from the grave, I can feel her judgment. Letting a man into my home and kissing him? A man who isn't my husband. A man who stood outside my window for weeks, watching me from afar. There is something wrong with him. Clearly, there is something wrong with me, too. Prologue. What's your name? I ask again, breathlessly.
Rinaldo.
Do you want to hurt me, Rinaldo?
Never.
He answers.
I only want to cherish you, Genevieve.
How do you know my name?
I know everything about you, just as I know you will love me, too. Chapter 1. The Phantom. March 18th, 1944. This will be the third man I've whacked today, and I've run out of patience for their useless begging. Typically, I leave this job to the enforcers in the Salvatore family, but ending a man's life offers a release unlike any other vice. Cigarettes, whiskey, birds, none of them have the same effect. It's their damn talking that threatens the peace I find after making a heart stop.
No, no, wait, let me explain,
the kid pleads, his nasally voice cracking from terror. It's past midnight. The biting air and thick fog have settled around us on the Aurora Bridge. His desperation gets the best of him, and he attempts to land a blow on my left side. The kid is stupid to think I'm not used to men attempting to take advantage of my disability. I slap his fist away easily, then pop him in the nose for daring to try. Blood spurts from his nostrils, and while he groans and mutters insults beneath his breath, I loop ropes around his ankles and tie them into a tight knot. Sweat and grease mat his overgrown hair to his forehead, and motor oil stains his navy blue coveralls, now joined by the blood pouring from his nose. By trade, he's a mechanic, but his interests have always been in the mafia. His mother had ties to a family in New York City, but she refused to raise him in the family business. He's a Cugine. For the past few months, he strived to be made and has pledged his loyalty to the Salvatores, a pledge he failed to keep, which is why I've tied cinder blocks to his feet. If anyone discovers his body, they'll find a bullet through his mouth, a clear message of his crime. You're a ratworm. You were feeding information to the Baldellis, I remind him dryly. Angelo nicknamed him for his pinched facial features and grating voice. Not sure what his real name is, but I'm sure his obituary in the Seattle Times Sunday newspaper will confirm it, assuming he's ever found. The media will recognize the message and know his death resulted from organized crime, and the public will undoubtedly look at the Salvatores. Angelo has owned Seattle for the last 2 decades and been declared the capo di tutti I capi. He's allowed other families to conduct business in Seattle with his permission, and of course, with the understanding that he'll receive a cut of their profits. However, 5 years ago, Don Manny Baldelli found an issue with that. He claimed his great-grandfather migrated from Sicily to Seattle first, making him the rightful owner of the city. After which, word got out that Manny was withholding Angelo's tribute and dealing guns under the table. Since then, war has broken out, and men are getting burned left and right. Families are choosing sides, and to this day, several bodyguards surround Angelo at any given hour. It's a dangerous time, and none of us walk the streets without checking over our shoulders.
You're giving me a bum rap, Worm insists vehemently. I ain't no rat, Ronnie. You know me. The Baldellis forced me into that car, but I didn't tell them nothing. Please, you have to believe me.
One of our crew, Lloyd, spotted him getting into a Baldelli car 2 nights ago, and it just so happens Worm showed up in an expensive suit yesterday with a brand new Rolex on his wrist. The timing wasn't a coincidence, and the kid made it obvious that the rival family had paid him off. Don't call me Ronnie, I clip. It's the only response I bother to give him. There isn't any point in arguing with the kid. He's already marked. If I'm not the one to ice him, one of Angelo's enforcers will. Worm opens his mouth again, preparing to plead his case some more, but I take the opportunity to shove my revolver in his mouth and pull the trigger. A car passes, but rather than slowing, they hit the gas. I make quick work of removing the Rolex from his wrist and stuffing the piece in my pocket. Later, I'll return it to the Baldellis to let them know their investment has been wasted. Next, I slump Worm over the railing and lift the cement blocks, tossing them over. His body careens over the edge and into the canal, the following splash echoing in the night air. Finally, some goddamn peace and quiet. I roll my neck, relieving the tension gathered in my shoulders. Not only is their begging useless, but quite bothersome, too. Heading back toward my car parked on the other side of the bridge, I whistle the tune to Just One More Chance by Bing Crosby. March 18th, 1944.
The numbskull got sauced and lost $300 to Tommy. But did that stop him from playing another round? Of course not. Now he owes Tommy $500.
It's late in the morning, and I'm on my way to report back to Angelo about completing Worm's contract last night, when Santino's words catch my attention, his voice ringing out from the family room in Angelo's estate. Quickly, I detour in his direction, tucking the rucksack with Worm's bloody Rolex inside the inner breast pocket of my trench coat. I take it upon myself to stay informed when it concerns the family. Tommy and Santino are Angelo's cousins, so if someone owes Tommy money, that means they owe Angelo money. I round the corner and lean against the doorframe, catching Santino's attention. He's sitting on the sofa next to his mother, Kay, who is scoffing at the sap who's now indebted to the Salvatores, and for quite a bit of money at that. "Who's this guy you're talking about?" I ask, folding my arms over my chest. Santino's only 17, and while he's invested in the family business, he's also a blabbermouth. Today, it's a good thing, but one day, it might get him iced. If he even comes home from the war after he's drafted in a few months, that is.
"Name's John Parsons. He and his detective friend Frank Williams have been coming to the lounge for the last few months. He had the funds at first, but the dip keeps trying to get his money back and can't pay no more. Tommy challenged them to a game of poker last night, and John couldn't seem to help himself."
I raise a brow, surprised Angelo's cousin was gambling with Frank. He's one of the leading homicide detectives in Seattle, and is typically the one working on the cases that have resulted from the war between the mafia families. He's also firmly in Angelo's pocket, and is very well acquainted with the two of us, unbeknownst to John. "Tommy gambled with the fuzz?" Santino grins.
"No one's ever called him a genius, Ronnie."
I'm tempted to bark at him for calling me Ronnie, but learning about this Parsons fella is more important than arguing with a kid about my damn name. I've smacked every male member of this family upside the head for calling me that, and every single one suffers from short-term memory loss. I've always hated it. Reminds me of my father, who bore the same name. And even still, it hurts to think about him. Angelo's father called me by it as a young boy, and it lived on through his son. The rest of the family follows his lead, despite my misgivings. "John Parsons," I state, bringing his attention back to the matter at hand. "Who is he?" Santino shrugs.
"Don't know. All I know is he didn't pay Tommy a dime. Promised he'd come up with the money later, but I think we all know how that goes."
"You know anything else about him?" I question.
"Just that he owns Parsons Manor down by the Sound. He kept going on about it while he was draining a bottle of whiskey,"
Santino responds, annoyance in his tone.
"Fellow wouldn't shut up."
I push off the door frame and head back toward the front door of Angelo's estate. I'll report to Angelo later.
"Hey, Ronnie, if you're gonna whack him, let me come, yeah?"
he calls after me.
"Santino,"
Kay admonishes. I don't bother responding. If I wanted one of Angelo's crew to handle anyone for me, I sure as hell wouldn't enlist a kid to do it. Soon enough, he'll get plenty of experience pulling a trigger, and he's better off pointing that gun toward a Nazi than someone like John Parsons. Santino's got bigger things to focus on than the organization. He's got a war to worry about. March 18th, 1944. Parsons Manor is unlike anything I've ever seen before. If it were in downtown Seattle, it'd stick out like a sore thumb. With the black siding and gargoyles poised on top of the roof, it looks like it came straight out of the Dracula film. Houses like these just don't exist in this city. Yet, here I stand. Tucking my hands in my trench coat pockets, I stroll through the front yard. An array of colorful flowers bloom in front of the black-painted porch, making the house look like a gloomy storm cloud among a bright rainbow. It's an interesting house, and it only strengthens my curiosity about who John Parsons is and why the hell he's residing in a home like this. My question is answered a moment later when when movement in the large bay window catches my eye. A tall, curvy woman sits down in a chair directly in front of the glass. Instantly, I'm riveted by the sight of her. Red stains her full lips, and her black tresses are curled to perfection. She wears a canary yellow dress, the sleeves drooping down the sides of her arms, the fabric clinging to her curved waist. My heart stills, like God himself froze time as I watch her peer down at something in her lap. One side of her mouth curls upward the slightest bit. By the way she angles her head and moves her arm, she appears to be writing. I'm entirely smitten by her. And though there's no way for me to know, I'm confident she is the mastermind behind Parsons Manor. Hypnotized, I drift toward her, my mind vacuumed into a trance that it can't seem to find its way out of. I'm not only riveted by her, I'm possessed by a need to have her. And she must be mine. As if she heard my internal proclamation, her head lifts and her gaze locks onto me. It feels like a bolt of lightning strikes through me where I stand. Her mouth parts, shock rounding her eyes at the corners, and though it appears like fear is sinking its claws into her, she's no less vexing. I came here to learn who John Parsons is, and the only thing I know is that he comes home to the most beautiful woman alive, and he doesn't deserve it one damn bit. Her hand drifts over her heart, a chunky gold pen woven through her fingers. What is she writing? And will she write about me? I'd love nothing more than to be consumed by her words, no matter how they greet me. Whether it's through those red-stained lips or from her delicate hands, I want to know every facet of her, every centimeter of her, mind, body, and soul. Chest tight, my movement mirrors hers, and my hand drifts over my heart where it clenches almost painfully. It takes monumental effort to draw my gaze away from hers, to take a step away, then turn and slowly retreat down her extensive gravel driveway. The trek to my car parked on the street takes several long minutes, yet I don't remember a single second of it. She plagues my mind, infecting it like a parasite and overriding any autonomy over myself. My free will is indebted to her, and without her, I am nothing. I shut the door to my Cadillac and can only sit there and mourn the life of John Parsons' wife. She will never be the same, as I am not. Her husband has unintentionally dragged her into a world where she doesn't belong, yet it is I who will never let her leave.
Chapter 2. The Raven. March 19th, 1944. 5 men have perished in this house. Some days, I wonder if I'll meet my own tragic end here too. I'm sure my husband will be the culprit. With the stress he's causing me, my heart is destined to give out. We have no money, and no other friends or family we can lean on. We have nothing, and we are alone in our nothingness. Teardrops stain the piece of paper on my lap from the debt collectors that proves just how little we have left. It's dated from 2 days ago, and he never thought to tell me. I found it peeking out from a stack of opened mail on the counter, along with bank statements declaring his accounts in the negative. There was nothing unordinary about the papers, yet a little voice in my head told me to look. And my God, part of me wishes I hadn't. We're in danger of losing our home. There isn't enough money to pay our mortgage, let alone any of the utilities. He spent almost everything. Everything. How will we support Serafina? Feed her, clothe her, ensure she sleeps in a warm bed? She works in a deli after school a few days a week to learn some responsibility and fund her war tax stamps. And truthfully, to sustain her ice cream addiction, too. But I could never ask her to pay the bills. She's only 13 years old, for God's sake. It's not uncommon for parents to rely on their children these days. Times are hard, and war is rampant. But until now, we've been able to shelter Sarah from a lot of those hardships. And why should she have to pay for his mistakes? We've always had the security from the wealth passed down in John's family, along with his successful bookkeeping firm, and it's kept us more than comfortable. I never expected that he'd do something like this to us. He spoon-fed me lavish fantasies when he courted me, and like a fool, I ate them up. He swore he'd build me a house with my odd sense of style, and he followed through with that promise because it made me happy, even at the cost of those poor men who died building it, causing society to turn their noses up at us. But he also swore that we'd surpass his grandfather's wealth, and we'd live a life of luxury beyond our dreams. He swore that one day he'd buy us a big boat, and we could sail across the ocean. So many promises. And instead, he went and spent it all. My throat tightens as I recall the man who lingered outside my window yesterday. I had convinced myself he was just another lost soul. But now that I know the trouble John has gotten us into, I'm second-guessing myself. If a man is coming onto our property, it can only mean John's done something terrible. As frightening as it is, I wonder if he has somehow gotten mixed up with the wrong people. And now Sarah's and my life could be in danger. Oh, John, what have you done?
Mama, I'm hungry. Is there anything to eat?
Sarah's quiet voice draws me away from my sorrows. Hurriedly, I swipe away stray tears from my cheeks and turn to face her with a bright grin. I've been sitting in my rocking chair at the window, trading off between staring at the piece of paper in shock and staring out the window mournfully. Sure, baby. You want me to whip you up some lunch? She smiles, and a brightness radiates from beneath her freckled cheeks. She's a beauty among the ashes that seem to collect in this damned home.
Yeah, it tastes better when you make it.
I snort. She swears that her sandwiches never taste as good as mine, even if we use the same exact ingredients. Regardless, I've always loved doting on her. One day, she'll stop asking for my help, and I'm reluctant for when that day arrives. Sarah takes off toward the kitchen, while I detour to the small washroom in the hallway. I reapply powder to my stained cheeks and refresh my ruby red lipstick, until not a single trace of my turmoil is to be seen. Perfect. My daughter will never know just how close her world is to crumbling down around her. When I make my way back through the living room, I relish the beautiful checkered tiling that expands all the way into the kitchen. There, Sarah sits at the island, her feet swinging as she focuses on her homework. The sight immediately dulls the persistent ache in my chest. Oh, what I wouldn't give to feel that childlike innocence once more. Anything but Sarah. What are you hungry for, sweet pea? I ask as I trek into the kitchen, my house shoes clacking against the floor. She shrugs.
I don't know.
How about elephant tails? I suggest. She pauses her homework to look up at me with a wrinkled nose.
Ew, no.
Panda tongue, giraffe hooves.
Mom,
she whines, drawing out the syllable. A silly grin paints her face, however, and I consider my mission successful. Okay, fine, I relent dramatically. How about a turkey sandwich?
Yes, please,
she says, her cheeky grin widening. Or, I pause, turkey feet. She sighs theatrically as 13-year-old girls do, and I turn to the fridge to grab the ingredients, though my smile quickly fades beneath the artificial light. How much longer will she be able to eat so freely, rather than wonder when her next meal will be? Pushing it from my mind, I paste a grin back on my face and begin prepping her sandwich. It's a requirement that I cut off the crust from each slice of bread before the turkey, cheese, and mustard go on.
Daddy said we're getting a new car and he'll let me drive it, Sarah announces casually.
I pause, the knife in my hand poised just above the bread. What? I ask breathlessly, my heart having vacated my chest.
Yeah, she chirps. He said we're going to be super rich, and he'll buy me the Cord 812.
I blink, forcing myself to focus on slicing the bread rather than my trembling fingers. Sarah knows nothing about cars, but my husband sure does, and I've heard him talk about that specific car frequently. It's one of his many dream automobiles, and now he's gone and made sure that it will stay a dream. Bastard.
Did he now?
I question, forcing a serenity that I don't feel into my tone.
Yep.
I finish with both slices before I can find the breath to ask.
And when did he say this was happening?
She shrugs for a second time.
Didn't say.
It feels as if a rock has formed in my throat, and anger slowly pollutes my bloodstream. How dare he make such grandiose promises when we're on the brink of homelessness? And to Sarah, of all people. I could forgive him for getting my hopes up, but certainly not my little girl's.
Well, that's something Daddy and I will have to talk about. Maybe something a little safer once you're older. How about a Dodge?
Her nose wrinkles again.
That sounds boring, like an old people car. You should drive that jalopy.
I scoff and hand her the plate with the sandwich atop, complete with a handful of potato chips.
I'll have you know, I am still young and beautiful, little girl.
She giggles around a bite of food while I struggle to keep my smile plastered on my face.
You are, Mama.
My heart eases a fraction, and I walk around the island to place a soft kiss on her head. Love you, sweet pea.
Love you too.
Her words are garbled, but this time, I don't berate her for talking with food in her mouth. I'm not sure how much longer she'll have that luxury. March 19th, 1944. I'm a pipe on the verge of combusting when my husband comes home, my cheeks flushed hot with anger. He's late, which used to be an unusual habit, but has become more typical of him in recent times. Since the moment Sarah went to bed, I've been in my rocking chair, glaring out the window and stewing in my fury, planning all the harsh words I would dare say to him. He's always been hot-tempered, but my wrath has proven to burn brighter a time or two. The front door shuts behind him, and John comes sauntering toward me, several envelopes in his hand. His eyes are red, and once he's near enough, I detect a faint whiff of booze. My husband has always been conventionally handsome, with short, light brown hair that is as thick as it is soft, and always seems to be effortlessly windswept. Unusual, light brown eyes, a square jawline, an aristocratic nose, and an incredibly charming smile. When we were teens, he had birds lining up for him, hoping for just a minute of his attention. He's always been tall, handsome, and wealthy. Now, only two of those things are true.
You have a letter from Daisy,
he announces, dropping an envelope onto the footstool in front of me. Familiar handwriting scribed over it. She and I have been best friends for nearly 3 decades. We write to each other often since she moved to Spokane. However, Daisy is the least of my concerns right now.
Did you happen to promise our daughter a luxury car?
I ask, my tone dangerously sweet. He grins and tugs at his tie, exhaustion weighing down the corners of his lips. John has always been a hard-working man, yet his spending habits have proven to work harder.
She's nearly 14. Gives her something to work towards,
he says casually, as if he's not getting our little girl's hopes up, only to let her down so cruelly. You want to explain how on earth we're going to afford that? His brow furrows.
Genevieve, what are you on about?
We received a letter from the debt collector. We can't afford the mortgage payments right now, let alone food. So why would you promise her a car? His face drops, guilt instantly coloring his eyes.
Baby.
Don't you dare address me that way, Jonathan. When were you going to tell me?
There's no need to get bent out of shape, Gigi. I'm going to get it all back, I promise you.
He swears, coming to crouch in front of me before taking hold of my hands. He stares up at me with a softness I see only when he requires my forgiveness. I'm seconds away from blowing a gasket. Where did it go? With your inheritance and business, you've always made more than enough to support us. And yet there's nothing to show for this money spent. He never came home with lavish gifts for Sarah and me, hasn't bought any new vehicles, no expensive jewelry or any impromptu vacations, and he so clearly hasn't paid off the house yet. It doesn't make any sense. He works to swallow, radiating a nervous energy.
I had a few too many poker nights with Frank,
he admits. I'm shaking my head in disbelief before he can finish. John, you didn't, I breathe. You gambled away our life savings.
Keep your voice down.
He shushes, a tinge of anger in his tone. Truly, I believe he's only embarrassed, as he should be. How do you expect to recover? I ask, lowering my voice for Sarah's sake.
I don't know,
he admits.
I could count cards or—
I stand abruptly, tossing my journal onto the chair before I pace the checkered floor, so overwhelmed that I can no longer sit still. I've married a dip. Do you realize how unbelievably dangerous that is? John, if you're caught, you could end up in the hoosegow, or worse, you could— I can't even bear to finish that sentence. He could be killed, and Sarah and I would be stranded. Worse yet, what if they came for us instead? Maybe that man outside the window was a debt collector, but did he come from an agency, or is he a part of something more sinister? It's not my own life I'm concerned about, but Sarah's. I can't even begin to fathom how he could put her in such a position. He steps toward me, holding his hands out in a calm down gesture.
I swear to you, no matter how I do it, I'll make everything back, tenfold. Soon our pockets will be so deep we won't know what to do with all of it. I'm so close to getting this game down.
I'm not stupid enough to believe him. When a gambler promises to make back everything he's squandered through more gambling, then he's well and truly lost. But what am I supposed to do? I'm a housewife with no skills of my own. John has refused to allow me to work, preferring I take care of the house and our daughter. But Sarah is older now, so if he keeps this up, I may have no choice. For now, I am as bound to my husband as he is bound to a poker chip. I give him my back, staring at the home that was supposed to embrace this family, yet has only borne witness to sorrow. Tears well in my eyes, and helplessness takes root. We are so much worse off than I imagined. If he had frivolous spending habits, we could sell those things and recoup our losses. But our money is tucked in the pockets of other men, and they won't be so kind about returning it.
Gigi,
he pleads, but I hold up a hand, silencing him. You're destroying this family, Jonathan, I choke out, the words as unstable as my heart rate. And I have no choice but to let you. March 22nd, 1944. I must be living in a nightmare, a waking nightmare that I cannot seem to escape. John will fix this. He has to. If he doesn't, then what will become of Sarah and me? The family that is left between John and me is sparse, and they do not have the means to take us in. We'll be left in the streets. He will fix this. Dear God, let him fix this. Chapter 3, The Raven, April 4th, 1944. There's a strange man outside my window. He wears a black fedora and a trench coat, and he shields his face from me. My hand trembles as I repeat the words in ink, forever ingrained in my journal. This isn't the first time I've seen him, and I'm convinced he's here for John. For 2 weeks now, my husband's been working on getting our money back. Each night it's a different story. He wins some, only to go belly up. He was out late playing poker last night, and it's likely he didn't make back enough to pay his dues. Maybe this man is here to collect on a debt he's owed, or to hurt me. Whatever the case, I'm terrified. I had hoped he was no more than an apparition when I first saw him, but now I can see there is nothing ghostly about this man. He is as real as the heavy beat of my heart, and his presence as potent as the adrenaline coursing through my veins. Yet, I'm also intrigued. Even through the glass, I swear I can feel his burning stare. It's caressing my face, down the column of my throat, and over my breasts. An undeniable burn has settled low in my stomach, something I haven't experienced in years, not since John and I first began courting. I'm unsure why this mysterious man is causing such a visceral reaction, or why I'm allowing it to continue. I should call the authorities, call for help, and plead for John to come home straight away. Still, I do nothing, say nothing. I'm home alone and terrified, but I'm also intrigued. April 6th, 1944.
Is there something out there that I'm missing?
Frank's sudden voice jolts me out of my daydream, startling me and nearly sending my heart flying out of my throat. Hand over my chest, I stare up at him with widened eyes. His brow is furrowed, and his blue-green eyes are filled with concern. Despite his charming smile, he has strong features, with his sharp jaw, cleft chin, and pointed nose. He has the type of face that instills fear when he gets a certain look in his eyes. I suppose that's what makes him such a good detective. "You startled me," I breathe. Frank grins, then pointedly stares out of the bay window beside me.
Are you looking for something?
My shadow. No one, of course. Don't be silly, I answer, chuckling nervously. My visitor came back earlier this morning, again standing in the tree line, just watching me, as he has been for the past couple weeks. I was too afraid to confront him, so I sat in my chair and watched him back, hoping and praying that he didn't dare to break into my home. He left after an hour, yet my heart has refused to settle. Frank scrutinizes me carefully while he pulls out his tobacco pipe from his coat pocket.
John tells me you've been busting his chops lately.
I huff, fluttering my hands over my dress, only to give them something to do. Frank Williams and John have been the best of friends since I met my husband. Frank's around nearly as much as John, and knows me just as well, too. It seems you have enabled these new habits, haven't you? I accuse, sending a cross look in his direction. He takes a few moments to suck on his pipe, little ringlets of smoke releasing past his lips.
Of course I haven't. I go along to ensure his safety, but I don't partake.
Why haven't you stopped him? I snip. He guffaws.
Have you tried to change his mind, dear? He's as stubborn as a bull.
I shake my head, so incredibly disappointed. For a long while, I was completely taken with my husband. I loved him thoroughly, and now I don't know anymore. I haven't known for years, truthfully.
I've offered to help,
Frank announces. That draws my focus back to him, surprise flashing through me. Help? Help how?
The mortgage payment was late, and I paid it, so you and Sarah wouldn't be without a home,
he says, flashing a suave smile my way. Instantly, embarrassment stains my cheeks red. It's almost unheard of to pay for another man's bills. Just as quickly, I'm stricken with concern. John is in debt to his best friend, and that makes me deeply uncomfortable. And while there is a tinge of relief that Sarah and I won't be on the streets as of yet, there's a pit in my stomach, eating away at my insides. For the first time, I'm grateful John and I didn't have a huge family like we had initially planned. My pregnancy with Sarah was extremely complicated, and I nearly died giving birth to her. I awoke in a hospital bed with my uterus removed from an emergency surgery and a healthy newborn baby. It was devastating for John and me that we would never be able to have another, but the two of us were eternally grateful for the one we did have. Sarah is more than enough for us, but there's always been a residual pain on the backside of my heart, grieving the children I'd never have. But now I am grateful. I am so beside myself, trying to figure out how we'll support Sarah. I couldn't imagine having multiple kids to worry about. Frank crouches in front of me, the tobacco pipe tucked in his pocket again. He rests his palms on my lap. Heat sinks into my knees and deepens the cavernous pit beneath my ribs.
I will always take care of you, Gigi. You should know that.
That's not your duty, Frank, I snap.
Maybe not,
he concedes.
But I am happy to provide for you when your husband cannot. You and Sarah are family to me, and I love you both dearly. I would never allow anything to happen to you two.
While Frank has expressed his love for us on many occasions, something about this proclamation feels different. Maybe because he only speaks of Sarah and me rather than John and us as a family. It's unsettling to say the least, and in the back of my mind, I worry that now I am indebted to Frank, too. Clearing my throat, I say, it's greatly appreciated, but I'm sure this won't happen again. Yet we both know that's a false hope. John isn't getting any better. He's getting worse. Deliberately, I remove his hands from my lap and stand, shuffling toward the kitchen where I can breathe.
Gigi, you know he's in far worse debt than just a mortgage payment,
he tells me. Irritation pricks at my nerves, and tension gathers in my shoulders. You don't think I know that? I snap, whirling to face him. He's drained all our money. Worse yet, he's been coming home sauced every night, slurring about how he's being cheated. We have nothing, Frank, and I will not allow you to continue to pay for his mistakes either. We may have a roof over our heads for another month, but we will be in no better a position if he doesn't figure out a way to fix this. He takes a step toward me.
I will do everything in my power to ensure that doesn't happen.
I exhale heavily and turn away once more. Just help him kick this habit. That's all I need from you, Frank.
I will, Gigi. I'd do anything for you.
He said that already, yet I don't feel any less hopeless or uncomfortable. April 4th, 1944. There's a strange man outside my window. I do not know who he is or what he wants from me, but I think he knows me. He watches me through the windows when John's not home. He wears a fedora on his head, concealing his face from me. I haven't told John yet, I cannot fathom why, but something keeps me from opening my mouth and admitting that a man is watching me from the shadows. John wouldn't handle it well. He'd go out with his shotgun and try to find him. I must admit, I'm more afraid of what would happen to my visitor should my husband succeed. I'm very afraid of this strange man, but my God, am I also intrigued.
Chapter 4, The Phantom, April 10th, 1944. Genevieve Parsons knows she's being watched, yet she didn't bother to lock her door. I can't contain the smile that comes to my face. I've been visiting her for weeks, though I've scarcely allowed her to see me. I've been staying hidden in the trees or just out of view from the window. She's fascinating when she thinks no one is watching. Too often, I spent hours circling the manor, viewing her through windows while she cleaned, sang along to the radio, or sat in her chair writing in her journal. She must write about me, and I'm curious to see what she has to say. Earlier today, she was staring out the window, a mournful look on her face. It wasn't the first time I'd seen her appear sad, nor the first time I'd long to run to her and make her forget about the husband I'm sure is ailing her. I could make her forget if I was inside her. My feet carried me to her as if I was in a trance. My body was no longer mine to control, but hers. She sat in her rocking chair and turned to look out the window, and it was like feeling the sun warming my face for the first time in years after being trapped in a dark dungeon. I watched with rapt fascination as her eyes landed on me and rounded at the corners. Fear flashed through them, yet I felt something entirely different. Hunger. All I felt was hunger. Her gaze continuously drifted back toward me as she attempted to ignore me, to favor her journal rather than holding my stare. She was frightened, and she was trying to hide from me. I fought with myself, tempted to walk through this very door and claim her as mine, but it was too soon. I needed to wait until her curiosity overrode her fright. Maybe that's already begun to happen, and her curiosity is winning. Did she leave the door unlocked just for me? It's not uncommon for normal civilians to leave their doors unlocked. Despite the rampant crime in Seattle, robberies are almost unheard of, unless they're actively related to the crime syndicate. It's unfortunate Genevieve has found herself at the center of a dangerous man's desires. I don't feel guilty enough not to step through the front door and softly close it behind me. It's the first time I've been inside Parsons Manor, and the interior is even odder than the exterior. Where the hell did she get her taste from? It's incredibly dark in here, but even with my limited eyesight, I'm able to glean a few details. A sparkling chandelier hangs above my head, dripping crystals from warped steel. The black and white checkered floor is prominent in the darkness, along with the black grand staircase directly ahead. Silently, I trek further into the home, finding the living room to the left of the stairs. My gaze instantly finds the large bay window on my far left. There is Genevieve's rocking chair with a stool placed right in front of it. It's where she sits while she pens in her journal. It's where I've seen her those few times I've caught her just watching the rain or staring almost longingly at the dark woods that surround her house. My footsteps are light as I walk over to the chair, running my fingertips along the soft red velvet. Then I lean down and inhale, catching a faint whiff of her perfume, I pick up subtle accords of cinnamon, amber, oak moss, sandalwood, and a touch of plum. A scent made just for my Genevieve. It suits her perfectly. Moving on, I note a black stone fireplace in the center of the wall before me, where red velvet couches surround it. Next to the fireplace is a stand with a radio atop, and I can imagine Genevieve and her daughter dancing next to it, laughing and singing along. I feel a small pang in my chest, knowing I don't have the privilege of joining them. I'm destined to watch from afar, outside the bay window. It's a life I'll accept for now, though it doesn't enrage me any less to know that John has the pleasure of filling that role. The kitchen is directly ahead, opposite the bay window. I'm tempted to make my way through toward the back of the house where their glass room is. I've only seen it from the outside, but considering all three walls and the ceiling are made of glass, it wasn't difficult to inspect the inside of the room. I'm sure it's beautiful there when the stars are out, but I'm too eager to see my Genevieve. I'm unsure of which bedroom is hers, but I imagine it won't be far from her daughter's. From my research on the Parsons, I've learned quite a bit about them, including little Sarah. If I have it my way, someday in the future, John will be gone, and Sarah will know me as a secondary father. I would never attempt to replace John, but I hope to find a way into her heart and will love her as Genevieve does. But that'll take time. I can be patient. The wooden steps hardly creak beneath my weight, thanks to years of practice keeping light on my feet. The air is colder up here, and it's nearly pitch black. I patiently wait to be able to make out the edges of the wall so as not to stumble into them. The first bedroom is empty, so I move on to the next one on the left side of the hallway. I'm careful as I open the door and find Sarah curled up in a ball, softly snoring. Leaving her be, I shut the door and move on to locate Genevieve's room. As I tread down the hallway, an ice-cold chill prickles at the back of my neck, stopping me in my tracks. Goosebumps scatter across my flesh, sending a tremor down my spine. Slowly, I turn my head over my shoulder, finding nothing behind me. Yet I feel a presence as surely as if blood runs through its veins. During my research into the Parsons, I came across an article recounting a fire that took 5 men's lives while building the manor. These lands claimed those souls, and I've seen shadows and angry faces a few times when hiding within the tree line. They don't scare me, though. I faced far worse souls than those of a few construction workers. Genevieve and John's bedroom is on the right side of the hall, far enough from Sarah to give them a sense of privacy, but close enough to hear if she's ever in distress. The door quietly creaks as I open it, the sound of John's snores arising as I enter. Their room is decorated as dark as the rest of the house, and if it weren't for the balcony doors on the wall opposite me, I would be sightless. However, the thin curtains allow moonlight to peek through, offering me a view of the 4-poster bed to my left. John snorts, his body jolting from whatever dream is playing behind his eyelids. He's on the side of the bed closest to me, and the sight of his sleeping form prompts an array of murderous thoughts. Without thinking, I slide my revolver from the back of my trousers, though I don't take aim. I just hold it while I fantasize about pressing the cool barrel to his forehead and pulling the trigger. The following pop would be as satisfying as watching the blood ooze from his skull. The urge is so demanding, I force myself to walk around to Genevieve's side, farthest from the door. At least John got that much right. She sleeps on her side, her hands held together as if she's praying and tucked beneath her cheek. Her hair is curled into rollers, a satin scarf wrapped around them. It's the first time I've seen her lips bare of red stain. I imagine it's a rare sight, one that John doesn't deserve. I get the inkling that her red lips are her armor, and I'd love nothing more than to be the one to strip it away and behold her at her most vulnerable. To see her face as bare as her body, lying on her back with her legs spread wide for me, her beautiful eyes sparkling up at me as she waits for me to worship her. My cock hardens at the thought, pressing painfully against my trousers. One day, I will convince her to grant me that honor, and when that day comes, she will never have screamed louder. While I still grip the gun in one hand, I bring my other fist to my mouth, biting down on the soft flesh as the fantasy takes flight, the different positions I could arrange that beautiful body in, the sounds that would spill from her lips. I'd leave no part of her untouched, whether it's my hands or my tongue doing the exploring. Fuck. It takes control I didn't know I possessed to take a step back. The carnal impulse to take her here and now is becoming difficult to suppress. I'd make her pathetic husband watch, unable to stop me from making his wife come undone in a way that he will never accomplish. Inhaling sharply, I tuck my gun back into my waistband and head toward the door, my movements wooden and robotic. It's physically painful for me to walk away from her, but I know that I must. I'm a bad man, but I won't be her monster. No, I want to be her savior. April 11th, 1944. It's late morning, and I'm leaning against a thick trunk right on the outskirt of the tree line, watching Genevieve watch me. I puff on a cigar, a luxury I rarely allow myself. I have distinct memories of my father smoking like a chimney, a habit my mother claimed he started when he was only 10 years old. Many times he came home on leave from the Great War, and I remember how he'd be hacking up a lung while sitting on the couch, doing absolutely nothing, unable to breathe around the tar in his lungs. I couldn't imagine how miserable he was during the battles, having to fight for his life while trying not to cough. However, I still enjoy an occasional smoke when I need to take the edge off. Booze is a vice I refuse to indulge in when my job requires that I be alert. All it takes is one night getting sauced for a rival family to take advantage. They won't put me in a grave so easily. Genevieve glances at me again, evoking a smile on my lips despite myself. She nibbles on her red-painted lips, continuously tucking her perfectly curled black strands behind her ear. A nervous habit, it seems. From what I can see, she's wearing a pretty pale pink floral dress. Just for me, baby? Crunching gravel beneath tires draws my attention away, prompting me to take a step back into the shadow of the trees. Moments later, a milk truck is cruising up her driveway. The curved front end reads Seattle Dairy. The driver's side is doorless, allowing the worker to get in and out quickly. The back end of the truck is completely open, with a flatbed and a metal canopy over it to